Hi there, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. The Cheltenham Festival is now tantalisingly close, and we'll be looking at the greatest meeting in the calendar, plus some hot news stories in this week's edition. Joining me, Lee Mottershead, are my colleagues Jonathan Harding and Matt Rennie. Hello to you both. And we begin by talking about the weekend. Kempton was the big card on Saturday in Britain, where Katate Dori romped away with the big race, a Ladbrokes Trophy. There were Cheltenham Festival clues, potentially, in the novice hurdles, and in Ireland, Intense Raffles and Nick Rocket booked their claims for the Grand National in the Bobby Joe Chase. Jonathan, you were at Kempton. You saw the Ladbrokes Trophy won in spectacular fashion by Katate Dori. Was he your takeout from the day?
I think, yeah, probably. It's a strange day, as much has been written about, that there are a few Cheltenham clues, but equally it's usually for horses now who are Aintree and beyond. Mm-hmm. Katate Dori is one who has three options at Cheltenham, not necessarily going to go there. I don't think that's been rubber stamped, but seems likely to. And he'd be the one really going forward for something like the Ultima after that impressive success. He's going to get, one would imagine, a massive hike in the weights, but I still think he could be quite competitive at Cheltenham because he came in off such a low weight, and to win that impressively, even carrying a low weight, was hugely impressive.
You impressed?
Very much so.
Could not be, could you?
No, not at all. And he's got three options at the Cheltenham Festival at the moment, in the Ultima, the national, the revamped National Home Chase, and the Kim Muir, but I'd be going for Biggest Glory of Evil in the Ultima, really. It's a race we know British trainers have done rarely incredibly well in over the past 20, 25 years. And novices do well in the race as well. Chianti Classico won it last year, limited experience over fences. And you could say Katate Dori, given what he did at the weekend, probably achieved far more than he has. Whether he's now hit his ceiling is another level.
Well, it depends when he goes up, I guess, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think, 13, 14, 12, 13, 14?
Something in that region, but hopefully the handicapper might not take the form to face value, because obviously Nicky Henderson said, Highland afterwards, said he hates it as much as Nicky hates eating kale.
So how do you feel about kale?
I can agree with Nicky Henderson fully on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kale?
Superfood, great for you, tastes great.
No,
it's all about that's why he's an award-winning reporter.
Exactly, that money's having a bit more care on myself. But I just think he's obviously an up-and-coming novice. I think maybe the race fell perfectly in his favour, but I'd be happy to back him for the Ultima. That would be the one I'd go for. And of course, we've talked about this year, they said it might have been a substandard renewal of the Ladbrokes Trophy, given, I think it was the joint lowest weighted top weight since 2002.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Ultima's likely to be substandard this year, given the drop in interest.
Massive drop in interest. From 70, actually, I wrote this yesterday, and I can't remember, some 70-something down to 49.
So wouldn't you view that as this is the best time to have a go at it? Because it's normally a very deep and competitive race of the best British handicappers, usually. So.
Yeah, well, because of the rating bans in place for the National Chase and the Kim Muir 145, I think. Was he 125 at the weekend? So he's going to go up to something knocking on around 140, isn't he? Mm. So he'll be towards the top of the weights in those two. In the Ultima, you'd imagine he's going to be something in the mid-150s heading the weights. Mm. So he's going to have a much nicer racing weight. Although, I mean, you made the point in your colour piece on Saturday, from what people were saying, that they don't see Cheltenham as a must-do target for the horse.
No, I mean, Sam Thomas was saying that they'll take the horse back and sort of decide. He seemed to be leaning that way, whereas the owner, Di Walters, essentially said, we'll leave it up to Sam, but did have quite a telling line. He said it's not all about Cheltenham. He'd be quite happy just to go and watch the racing and cheer on everybody else, he said. So well, I'd imagine, I would say more likely than not, he will run at Cheltenham. But the theme of the day was very much Aintree and beyond.
That sort of way that day has gone in recent years. It used to be a massive day of Cheltenham Festival trials, probably less so these days. Actually, on that point, well, Highland.
Yeah.
Why are you smile when I said Highland?
Because I'm just thinking about Nicky Henderson talking about him afterwards, and the kale line was great.
Oh, the kale line, yes.
And just how excited he was about him as a Grand National contender.
Because Nicky Henderson doesn't really do the Grand National in terms of going close to winning it, not these days anyway.
No,
but maybe this year.
It's become sort of a running thing, hasn't it? Every single year it's when will he finally win it, and then he always says, well, I have won it, I won the US National, which doesn't quite count
over
hurdles.
The line of life is where you often said he's done well in the Topham, so he can do one circuit, but not two circuits.
Oh, he's got plenty of lines on it, and he brought a few out at the weekend. But you sense with Highland, he thinks he's got a serious enough contender there, and you'd have to agree with him. That was as far as preps go on ground, he probably didn't quite like. That's pretty good going, I'd say.
Okay. What else? You were at Kempton on Saturday. Dovecut, we had a potential British challenger for the Supreme in Tripoli Fly.
Yeah, certainly a challenger. I think the Supreme has the big Irish horses in there. That's going to take a hell of a lot of winning for a British horse, but I think he certainly deserves his place after winning quite nicely there.
You said certainly a challenger in a way that suggested
I'd be surprised if he won.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows? But that is a race where I think the market's it's quite a strong race, the Supreme.
Copet de Bourg
dominates like it's going to be. Copet de Bourg was quite special.
Yeah, but Tripoli Fly's got some engine as well to do what he did at the weekend when still jumping, I thought, pretty substandardly.
Yeah.
There's a huge engine in there, but he's learning every time. He's going through the ranks. Maybe he won't be good enough, but even then, it's quite an interesting race, the Supreme. I know we've got Copet de Bourg, who's the red hot favourite, but he's still got to learn how to race properly, given he tanked his way throughout the whole of the Grade 1 at Leopardstown.
Yeah.
He could be a freak when he learns to settle. Salvatore Mundi did everything wrong in the Moscow Fly, yet still won. So, well, they're novices. They're not going to be the ultimate finished product yet. And maybe Aintree would be better for him on a flatter track as well. But Fergal's got a good team of novices to go to war with at Cheltenham. He's got... obviously, 6 Mile Bridge as well, who down Potter's Charm is going for Turners. So we know that Fergal wanting to get that festival winner, it's an itch they wanted to scratch for a while, and they've got two for the future which look very bright. Probably not up to the standard of the novices we've seen, but if you're not in it, you can't win it.
No, that's true. You mentioned a horse pulling very hard in Copet de Bourg, Mondo Man.
Yeah.
In the Adonis. Was billed as a potential triumph horse before his defeat at Ascot, where he pulled very hard. They thought they'd sorted that out. They hadn't, because he pulled like a train again.
Yes, head was going all over the place. Really just... you could tell that the whole aim of the day was to try to get him to settle. And in the sense, I suppose they did achieve that in a sense towards the end, as in that he did race behind and... but when it came time to come with a sort of finish, and it looked as though he had every chance to come and win the race, he just had used up far too much energy, and he just needs to... he almost races the wrong way around at the moment, but there is a very good horse in there if they can get around that.
What about Fairy House? We had the Bobby Joe Chase tradition, a proper Grand National trial. Knit Rocket beat Intense Raffles with Iron Maximus not able to run. Very minor setback. So Knit Rocket won the race. Intense Raffles was second, but based on the weights in the Grand National compared to what they had on Saturday, Intense Raffles should, if you're a weights and figures person, definitely turn the foot around.
Yeah, definitely. On if you're just going on like with the paper in front of you, I thought it was a great race for both of them. To be honest with you, at the Bobby Joe, and you wouldn't be surprised if both of them two are fighting out the finish in the Grand National. I'd more be on side with Intense Raffles, given it was his first chase run of the season as well. And he finished in front of him in front of Knit Rocket in the Irish National last year. They've both got endless amounts of scope to improve. It's just whether the new makeup of the National suits the horse of their class, or whether we're now going towards... Iron Maximus last year was already a Grade 1 winner before for the Bobby Joe, Grade 1 and Irish National winner. So you need that high calibre, class calibre of horse for the National these days. So I'm sticking with my anti-post punt of Grange Clare West, given he ran an absolute stormer in the Irish Gold Cup. But I thought it was a terrific trial for both, and you can see them being in there. Especially Nick Rocket's been... it feels like he's been around for a while, but he hasn't really. He was a novice last year, managed to run a stormer in the Bet365 Gold Cup as well. I think it just shows that we might be in for another Irish domination in the Aintree this year in the big race.
Could be a great Grand National, though, in terms of, if you look at the class of the horses in the race. I made that point in the column today. There's some tremendous talent in there, as you'd expect for a £1 million handicap. Even more valuable, this is a seamless link.
Really nice
segue. I'm going here.
Yeah.
The Ida Chase. No. The Saudi Cup took place on Saturday. Not my favourite part of the racing year, but even Saudi sceptics would say that it was humdinger of a finish.
Yeah.
I suppose the question is, should Romantic Warrior have won? He came five wide around the bend under James McDonald. A bit of movement there. Five wide around the bend. Cruised into the lead, past the Japanese star Forever Young, went clear and then got caught. Did J-Mac cost Romantic Warrior the race?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Myself. No, yeah. I think it was just a typical... I love Romantic Warrior. He's one of those kind of... International horses don't always cut through, to use a hideous marketing term, but he is one that just gets sent everywhere, always runs a massive race, and I think he ran his race in Saudi Arabia on dirt for the first time. Huge effort, and was just narrowly beaten by a better horse on the day. I'm sure if you re-ran that race 10 times, they'd each win it 5 times. I think they're just the two best horses by a long way. And it just so happens that this time Forever Young had that little bit of extra at the finish. But as far as flat racing goes, I don't think it gets much better than that.
Okay, that's your vote. Before you can have the casting vote, because I'm a huge J-Mac fan. I'd say he's arguably the best jockey riding the world at the moment alongside Ryan Moore. But I'm sure, my hunch is that if he could ride that race again, he would have waited before he pressed go on Romantic Warrior, who to my eyes was definitely the best horse in that race. It's 1-1. I say Romantic Warrior should have won. He said he shouldn't. What do you say?
Well, I mean, any jockey that finishes second by such a distance as that would want to have another go. I would say I was on the fence. I can see both sides why he had to go and make the challenge when he wanted to, or felt that it was right to make the challenge.
Yeah.
But it was 1 mile 1 on dirt, wasn't it? And he's a 1 mile 2 horse. So it's a different sort of test that he's faced before, different surface. I think I'd be leaning towards he should have waited just an inch, half a second, maybe a couple of seconds longer, because the straight in Saudi compared to other dirt tracks is quite lengthy compared to other ones we've seen, especially even the straights on the turf at Sha Tin in Hong Kong. I feel like there would have been a gap there, and he definitely, Romantic Warrior definitely had the acceleration to put the race to bed, whether he just did it half a furlong or a quarter of a furlong too early, who knows? But as Jonathan said, what a spectacle it was.
Yeah.
I know they're not in the most favourable of places for myself either, but for an international race, that's exactly what you want. But it also shows the dominance that the Asian, especially the Eastern Asian jurisdictions have on dirt or turf, really, with what Romantic Warrior's done. And then Forever Young is a brilliant dirt horse in his own right, won the big Japanese dirt race in Tokyo last year, was third in the Kentucky Derby, won the Saudi Derby on the undercard a year ago before winning the UAE Derby. He's probably the global dirt horse that's essentially the dirt champion across the world at this stage. I know Americans might have a go with us on there, but they didn't.
Sierra Leone.
They didn't turn up. So whereas Forever Young's been turning up, he's gone to America. I'm sure they'll be looking to go back to America in the international flavour that Yoshito Yahagi likes. So no discredit in that, and just we know they've been dominant for a long time, but Japan seems to have an absolute stranglehold on these international races, given what they achieved on the undercard as well.
Yeah, it was a massive undercard. They won the four big races.
Yeah,
it's not a surprise.
No,
we've said and written so much about it, but I think if you were to have a completely blank piece of paper and design a racing industry, it would look an awful lot like Japan's. They have the luxury of complete control. Every pound or yen they make goes back into it, you know.
And it also looks like they breed for an older horse, essentially, whereas over here we're looking at early juvenile precocity and speed. They're breeding to hold on to, as we know, for those to peak at 4 and 5, and that's why they come over to Europe when they do, to run in the Arc and then hoover up all these international races like they do as well. They're okay to play the patience game, and it works out terrifically for them.
Yeah, but they will not be winning at the Cheltenham Festival this year. Perhaps Yoshito Yahagi might start thinking about that at some point. We go into a commercial break now. When we return, we will be asking, has British horse racing sold Welsh greyhound racing down the river?
Do you want over £2,000 in Cheltenham free bets? Visit racingpost.com/freebets, the ultimate hub for betting offers. Racing Post. Stay ahead of the field.
Welcome back to the front page, and we move to politics now, because in the Welsh Parliament last week, it was announced by the Labour Deputy First Minister, Hugh Iranca-Davies, of an intention to ban greyhound racing in Wales. Interestingly, it came as part of a wider budget announcement in the Welsh Parliament, and it would mean, if the plan came into force, that the only Welsh greyhound track, Valley, would cease to exist for greyhound racing. Matt Rennie, you are the resident greyhound racing fan on the panel. Just talk about the ban for now.
Yeah, so it's come as a part of, sort of an economic budget deal with Labour, who run the Welsh Parliament at this stage, and it's come through, and it was said that Jane Dodds, also is who's the Liberal Democrat member of the Welsh Parliament, it was used in almost sort of a deal to ensure for her vote to get this proposed economic budget through. I just think it's such an ill-thought-out, rash decision that they thought they could just slip it into the background, essentially, of this deal, without really working or even consulting with the industry and the audience of Welsh greyhound racing. Obviously, I know it's only one greyhound track there, but just because it's going to happen in Wales, you're now leaving yourself open to it happening in England throughout greyhound racing, and then throughout greyhound racing as an animal sport. Is it going to snowball into that racing becomes under threat, firstly in Wales and then wherever else? We should be doing all we can to support animal sports, that especially ones that you know or you hope to know are run with welfare as a paramount interest, and we keep on top of that, and we should outlay those claims to devolved parliaments, even in national parliaments as well. And when you read what the chief executive of the GBGB said, in that they haven't, the parliament who are part of this deal haven't been consulting or even visited the greyhound track, I find that pretty scandalous, to believe that you can make such a decision that impacts such an industry and ends such an industry without having consultation from both sides. That's how grown-up politics should be, essentially. If you're going to make an informed decision, you have to have stuff from both sides and not just go, oh well, we haven't talked about it, but we don't need it anyway, because you know there's a lot at stake here. As Mark Johnston said, this needs to be a wake-up call, not only for British greyhounds, but for British horse racing as well, because it won't stop. It never does. When you give an inch, people take a mile. So if you're Chepstow, Foss Lass, Bangor, I'd be looking over my shoulders a little bit, looking for reassurances. I know the BHA gave its reassurances to welfare and Welsh racing in a statement, but we needed to give it to greyhound racing as well, because they work hand in hand. They're animal sports. There's a lot of cross promotion as well.
Yeah, well, that's in some ways the nub of the debating point on this one. So you referenced Mark Bird there, Matt, the chief executive of the Greyhound Racing Board. He put in his quotes last week when he was speaking to the Racing Post. He said, I'll also add that I've seen the statement issued by the BHA today and just spoke of confidence of British Racing's relationship with the Welsh Parliament, and spoke about how they have good relations with Parliament members, and spoke possibly about the future of racing in Wales, three racehorses in Wales, Bangor, Foss Lass and Chepstow. There was no reference within the statement to the BHA expressing any sort of view on the potential banning now of greyhound racing in Wales. And on that one, Mark Bird said, I've seen the statement issued by the BHA and was disappointed that it seems to disregard greyhound racing and focus purely on what it sees as a strong position for the three horse racing tracks in Wales. So, Jonathan Harding, I suppose the question is, was the BHA right? Was British Racing's leadership right to have as its position, well, we're not worried about racing in Wales? Should the BHA have been saying not only that, but we are really disappointed and angry that another animal sport is set to be banned in Wales?
It's a difficult question. I think it was right to essentially defend its own interests and say that we're not worried about the racecourses, because ultimately it's the British Horse Racing Authority and that's its first priority. But I do think some show of solidarity with greyhound racing might have been important. I don't like the idea of horse racing necessarily completely distancing itself from greyhound racing, and there seems to be a bit of a conversation about horse racing somehow, both as a betting product and a sport, being marked out as its own thing that doesn't have to sort of follow the same rules or be promoted in the same way as others. I think greyhound racing and horse racing have a lot of shared interest, and actually a bit of a show would have been quite helpful, I think.
Would British racing be tainted by an association?
And that's probably why they didn't come out, would be my guess. I'd be guessing at this point. I don't know what the motivation was for not showing an obvious show of support for greyhound racing, but the intimation by not doing it, and I'm sure it's how it's been perceived by greyhound racing, is that there is a bit of that, possibly a desire not to dip its toe in and get involved in something that's not really, you know, they don't want to lose out by association if they can see the mood music around greyhound racing.
So, does racing have some sort of moral requirement to come out fighting for greyhound racing? What if this situation, for example, was the Welsh Parliament announcing an intention to ban three-day eventing? What would the position be on that? I mean, because you can argue in some ways, racing has a closer relationship to three-day eventing and show jumping, given the horses. But you could alternatively argue racing, greyhound racing are the same as they are both betting sports.
Yeah, I think there is that sort of moral responsibility to it, but also when threats to animal sports like they are, when we're told, I think what racing has done really well over the last couple of years especially, is back up statements saying we're improving welfare with facts and figures and improvements. As we've seen, we know the Grand National might not be the same race it is anymore, but it was changes were needed to it on the back of the equine deaths that were happening in it. If the greyhound boards and the sport had the welfare facts to back up the welfare of greyhounds is paramount, and they've improved, and they've taken injuries into account to improve how the coping and the living with greyhounds, then we should have been there to back them up if they had the facts and stats there. I mean, I just think if you go into this sort of self-interest bubble at this sort of point, you're almost just sitting there as a sitting duck, and you'll be next. I think it's just a really sad situation and it feels very, it came out of the blue, and it just feels very rash and not thoroughly thought through.
There are parallels with this debate going on at the moment between, if you like, gambling and gaming. This view that racing would benefit if it more clearly delineated itself from your casino slots products that bookmakers put forward, on the basis that they are the ones that really are the cause of, or more likely to cause, problem gambling than betting on sport, betting on horse racing. But the alternative view is sort of what you said there, that if you do that, then ultimately you leave yourself more exposed. It's a very difficult one.
Yeah, that we hear that so often, don't we? This idea that racing should be marked out from casino-style games and other forms of betting. And it is obvious to anybody that there is a difference between investing in a horse, as it were, and doing your study and placing a bet and pressing a button multiple times in a game of chance. They are different. But I think perhaps it's gone a little bit too far. I think in an ideal world, it would be marked out and it would be carved out and it would be promoted differently and it would be totally separate. But that's not how life works, and bookmakers make a great deal of their profit will rely on cross-marketing and it will rely on cross-promotion of products. And I don't buy this idea that horse racing is somehow a kind of completely pure and saintly pursuit, betting on horse racing, whereas other forms of betting aren't. And I think that's possibly the greyhound stuff is playing into that a bit. It's often viewed as some sort of poor relation to horse racing, whereas actually, I think possibly there does need to be done actually to support that.
Irrespective of the decision, just what for me I just cannot comprehend is if Mr. Bird's saying is that there was no dialogue, no visiting the track before making the decision. That's what I cannot get my head around. If someone was to come to you and you can disagree with people on politics, on sports like of sports pursuit and animal sports, if they came with a reasoned judgment and reasoned argument essentially for them and backed it up, you would almost go, I disagree with you, but you've backed it up, and you know, we'll have a professional dialogue and a debate about it. if it's just been done without that and visiting the areas, you know, we've said it before in horse racing, we'd love people that who might be opposed to it come out to the stable yards and see how well the horses are treating, because we know that, but we're a big sport, but in the terms of the world, we're a really small sport, and greyhound racing is even smaller, and we will face this majority threat from ill-informed perceptions, basically. We can't just sit on our laurels with them, really. It needed a lot more dialogue, essentially, the greyhound ban in Wales, but instead it just feels like it's just been sort of thrown in there as an extra.
I suppose, and on that point, ultimately, I guess what this shows is the extent to which a sport, greyhound racing, plenty horse racing at some point, is vulnerable to politics, in the sense that the banning of greyhound racing seems here really to revolve around one Liberal Democrat member of the Synod, who the Welsh Parliament, who wants greyhound racing banned, and who the Welsh government needs her support to get its budget across the line. I mean, you're reading like BBC news stories on this, that they said that almost astonishment that a ban on greyhound racing has formed part of a budget deal. But again, it shows you can't live in a bubble in a sport. You are impacted by what goes on outside that bubble. And I say one Liberal Democrat politician, in effect, has brought this ban forward.
Yeah, and we shouldn't be afraid of our products as well. And I just feel like, as you said, that we... British horse racing had a lot of a moral obligation to support them, and I feel like we've kind of let them down on that front over this.
We move on to the final part of the front page today. We're going to rattle through a few of the last week's stories. Start, John, with Premier Racing. Half-term report came along last week. Wasn't entirely positive.
Yeah, it's the type of report card, if you took it home to your parents, they'd be pretty peeved.
You
I'd
would
imagine.
Never have to do that.
No, naturally, no. But I can, you know, it's completely predictable. I like the fact that we have a report card.
Yep.
And
yep.
that
fair
these
play.
Things
yep.
are being tracked. You have to say fair play to that. I just think it's essentially fallen at almost every hurdle thus far. Affordability will obviously be having a knock-on effect on betting turnover, but if Premier Racing is one of the countermeasures against that to grow that and better promote the product and to make racing more appealing and all the various other things, no doubt noble intentions that it has, it just feels as though it's been sort of half-baked at this point. It needed, my personal view, and the horse is massively bolted on this, is that they should have waited to release it. It got the softest of soft launches and has never really picked up to where it needs to be with national promotion and everything else. I'm aware of the financial realities. I'm aware a lot of people are putting a lot of work and do want it to be a success. But for me, you're either in or you're out. And at the moment, we're in some weird halfway. I mean, you wouldn't know you're at a Premier meeting.
No, I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? There has been no meaningful promotion or marketing of Premier Race Days as Premier Race Days, and they don't look or feel any different to how they did beforehand or to a core race day.
Well, that is the absolute key area where it's flopped. It's the non-existent marketing of the product. As Jonathan said, affordability has played a role, but I think there's only so many times you can keep going back to the old affordability issue. Mm-hmm. We know it's going to play a major role in affecting racing negatively for quite a long time, but it was just so rushed. Give yourself a bit of time to bring a proper marketing tool towards it. We've seen nothing to do with the marketing of it completely. If they've given themselves till, I don't know, starting it came in 2023, didn't it? And then New Year's Day in 2024 was the first Premier Race Day. Give yourself a year between it to get yourself a proper marketing team in there. Work out how essentially we're going to do it, because they've just bunged a load of about 170 fixtures together, which don't, and a lot of them don't stand out as Premier fixtures, you know. This is meant to be the best of the best. And maybe we have to be a bit cutthroat and just say, well, unless you've got like a group, minimum of a group two on your card, group two or grade two, you're not going to be a Premier fixture, because we need to be marketing the very best of the sport, essentially. It was just all, see, it was so, so rushed. And as you say, it's a nothing, state of nothingness for everyone. People in racing, the consumers as well, they see a little logo by the finishing line.
Yeah.
That's all we've got.
Yeah.
We've got nothing else. And it was I'm all for change, but it has to be, again, talking about the Welsh Parliament and the greyhound bans, it has to be well thought out with a thorough plan and a way of going forward. And it felt like it was just chucked there as sort of a almost a do or die method. We're either going to sink or swim with it. And I think we're completely down the idea of premierisation has sunk, essentially.
The City of York Stakes and the Long Distance Cup will both take place on Premier Race Days this year. Mm. And they will take place as Group 1s for the first time. And that was announced this last week. So there have been long-standing efforts by the BHA and by York and by the shareholders of British Champions Day to have the Long Distance Cup in the City of York upgraded to Group 1 status. That's always been rejected, largely. France Gallo responsible because of clashes with existing French pattern races. Perhaps to many people's surprise, after disappointment last year, they got over the line this year. They'll both be Group 1s. Really great work from BHA's Ruth Quinn, who's been working hard on this for years. Shows that they, I mentioned it in the column, sort of George Orwell better than War War. A lot of people might have said, what's the point of being in this European Pattern Committee that's holding us back? But of course, because of the European Pattern Committee, you have situations where you can't just introduce, say, a mile and a quarter, 5 million euro Group 1 in the same week as the Judmont International. Great work from Ruth Quinn, from the BHA, from York Stakes and Championships, from the Flat Pattern Committee, and for Mark Playplay to France Gallo for seeing the bigger picture on this one. We also saw an upgrade of a French staying race, a pre-contest Vigier, to Group 1 status as part of a wider attempt to further support the staying programme. And we got a new race on Champions Day, a £250,000 six furlong contest. Kitwell have wanted a two-year-old race on Champions Day for years. Lots of different races have been looked at. Millery Stakes, Judge Trophy, the Royal Lodge Stakes more recently. None of those have passed on. So we've got this new race this year in October. Just in general, happy with the changes?
That was a lot of good news.
Well, good news, wasn't segment. It? We need a bit of good news.
Yeah, nice. Light and shade and all that.
Yeah.
I've read so many stories in my time at the Racing Post about the City of York Stakes and why it should be a Group 1. So I'm relieved in the sense that it is now and we don't have to do those anymore. And I think it is completely deserving of that status. There's a lot of good work goes into getting it there. No one would begrudge William Derby or York anything. I think kind of York Racecourse and indeed Champions Day with that race being promoted as well are two of the things that you can hang your hat on as, okay, maybe there is a future to this game. You know, there is positives, there is things that you can look at, and yeah, pleased for them both.
And as a proud resident of York, you'll be particularly delighted.
Yeah, I can see the Knavesmire from my bedroom window. It's brilliant for the track, it'll be brilliant for the city as well in terms of the Ebor Festival, because there's a Group 1 on every day now.
Yeah.
That's a proper end of summer festival,
yeah.
Should I say. It really brings the height of the summer flat racing season to a really good crescendo. And I know there were questions about whether it merited it, given the most recent run, it was won by Breege. It was a substandard.
They were unlucky this year.
But they were really unlucky. The audience was a non-runner. Kinross was a non-runner as well. And Lake Forest reared up in the gates and had to be withdrawn. Well, we know Kinross is a Group 1 star and has been for ages. They'd attracted the Glockinge winner and the Lennox Stakes winner to the race. And Lake Forest has gone and won an absolutely unbelievably valuable race in Australia. So if that they all raced, it would have probably, we'd have been going here going, yeah, absolutely, it would have been great. Brilliant for York. The one thing I question is, what do you do with the Hungerford Stakes now?
Hungerford Stakes is always...
It's a week earlier. You can't have...
It's always struggled
in recent years. Yeah, it has really struggled. And you need that sort of pyramid to get to the City of York Stakes. So obviously the criterion's now at York.
Yeah.
In late June, it's a Group 3. The next logical step a month later is the Lennox Group 2. And then you're into the City of York Stakes Group 1. Whereas the Hungerford being a Group 2 sort of in purgatory. It either needs to be a Group 3 or lost, really, because they're not going to attract the horses of the City of York Stakes is going to, nor in the Prix-Maurice de Guise, the sprinter having to go at 7 furlongs. But that's for the pattern and people above my pay grade to decide. Great for the staying division. I have to say, and I'm glad. It's a division which has really captured people's imaginations recently with Kyprios, Stradivarius, Trushan. They're the most with Stradivarius retired now, but the others are the most popular horses in training, essentially, in flat on flat.
Yeah,
anyway.
Absolutely. And on that one as well, there'll be a new Group 1 for two-year-olds on Irish Champions Weekend in 2026 over a mile and a furlong, the Golden Fleece, which is an interesting development too on that front.
Very much so. And it's been a good race. It's been won by Auguste Rodin recently as well. And it seems like the two-year-old shape up of the two-year-old season's got itself into really good shape, which is why I'm not slightly sceptical about this new two-year-old race, because it's going to be a conditions race. Be interested to see what calibre horse it was going to attract. But as a whole, the way the British and Irish juvenile sort of system works, I think it's really, really well. It builds to the crescendo with the Middle Park and the Cheveley Park Stakes, the Dewhurst and the Futurity Trophy at the back end of the season, when it should be Group 3s, Group 2s, and you build to your Group 1s. So it wouldn't have been right if, say, the Mill Reef got switched to Ascot, because you're essentially... It might have attracted those that have been beaten in the Middle Park, really, but it's not a champions race, in a way. But that's just, it's nice it's another big race on Champions Day, in a way, but I'm really impressed with the Stayers one, and well-deserved for the Long Distance Cup as well. And if there's any sort of doubts about people not going to the Cadran and to go to the Long Distance Cup, well, Trushan's done both recently in running and winning both, and Kyprios did the double last year as well. So it's doable, and hopefully that works as a benefit for all in Europe, European racing as well.
And the pre-Royal Oak has been mentioned, but that's always overlooked these days by the Long Distance Cup, and that was the case as a Group 2. Anyway, just finally, a bit of a plug, if you are a Racing Post Plus member, you'll know that there was an interview with Dan Skelton. Came out on Saturday evening. It was in Sunday's Racing Post. Dan talking about his huge festival, Cheltenham Festival Challenge. He was a big flag bearer for Britain last season. Lots on the horses, but also on issues. Just pulling one of the things out that Stuart Riley got from Dan in his interview. Dan repeated his view that the Grand National Festival and the Grand National should come at the end of the British jump season. So in effect, push back from early to mid-April to the end of April, in effect replacing Sandown's Jumps Finale as the last hurrah of the season. We've already had one vote in this programme. We're going to have one more. I'll go first. Dan, great to have ideas. I don't particularly like this one myself, so I'd be a no. What would you be, Matt?
Well, it's very similar to the other one. I'd say probably sitting on the fence. I'd probably lean more towards no at this stage, but with a further tweaks, it could be an idea that gains traction.
Okay, Johnny's not going to be deciding vote because it's two no's already, but anyway, go.
No.
Okay.
But that's the sort of innovation we need.
We need ideas. Yeah, we need ideas.
We can go through it. I mean, the Grand National, as we've said, is a completely different race to what it was 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
So the horses that would have got into the Grand National 10 years ago now have the option either a week later in the Scottish Grand National or 2 weeks later in the Bet 365 Gold Cup. So you can't really... It's really hard because it's such a rigid format, and I think we should have more British horses over at Punchestown personally. But that's just
I'm sure Punchestown wouldn't welcome the Grand National Festival going to
exactly
the end of April.
And also the Irish come over for Cheltenham, so why shouldn't we reciprocate it at the end of the season when there's a 6 week break?
Absolutely. Okay, I think that is probably that. Anything else you want to talk about? We covered everything.
Champions Series coming to an
end. Oh yes. Didn't ever really start, did it?
Similar to premierisation, in a way. I said beforehand, it got lucky in its first year that Frankel was around, and it sort of boosted it a bit when because Frankel was around, and then Champions Day was switched to Ascot when Frankel was winning all the races as a three-year-old, becoming a real star.
But even then, nobody spoke about the fact he was running in a British Champions Series.
As a great lover of neatness and order, I like the idea of races leading and being part of a series and it all being very tidy and you can have a nice wall chart and everything will be great, but I just don't know if anyone was all that aware of it, really. Well, that's probably a little bit harsh. It was well intentioned and it worked to help build Champions Day up as a kind of road to it, but Champions Day became so big that it's its own thing and the road to it is sort of doesn't really matter to me.
Yes.
There's no definitive road in the flat season as well. You think about, we've got Derby in early June, Royal Ascot in June, then you're into the King George and the three-year-olds merging into facing the older horses. You know, the flat season doesn't have what Jumps has nowadays in the monster that is Cheltenham, and you're never going to make Champions Day like Cheltenham because of, there's many mitigating factors, the ground being one of them, but the international targets like the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe and Breeders' Cup as well are still a strong lure for people over here.
Yeah, exactly. I think our road has come to an end now. So we thanks you, Jonathan. Thanks to you, Matt. We thanks to you for watching. We'll wrap this up. Just a reminder that our festival preview coverage is now well and truly underway. The first Ultimate Festival preview night piece was in Monday's Racing Post with Mark Holder. Patrick Mullins follows on Tuesday. Keep abreast of all that and everything else that we do. And until next time, bye-bye.